All right. Good morning. My name is Michelle Martin. I'm a fourth year doctoral student at Penn State, and I am very excited and grateful to have this opportunity to present this work with you all today. So before I get started, I'd like to disclose that I have no relationships to disclose. So what I'd like to do first is give you all an overview of what I'd like to go over today. So my goal is to get through these questions in the time allotted. So first off, I'll start a bit about who I am, how I ended up in El Salvador, which is where the study was conducted. Give you a bit of background on that so you can kind of, so we can all shift our geographical thinking right now. I'll go into the objectives of this study, the methods that I utilized, as well as some of the preliminary results. So I would like to state that these results are like hot off the press. So I don't know, I'm really excited about it. And I am still in the process of really learning from this data. And then I'd also like to go into answering the question of why this work is important, which is one of the, I think, the most important questions we need to ask ourselves as investigators in public health. And then I'll go into some next steps that I think are important to take. All right, so a little bit about myself. As I said, I'm a fourth year doctoral student at Penn State in the Department of Biobehavioral Health. I actually came to El Salvador for the first time in 2012 during an alternative spring break trip as an undergrad student. I really enjoyed my time there and decided to keep that connection. And that connection keeps me going back, and my time there influences and inspires my research interest. So where is the study conducted? So I'm not sure about your knowledge regarding El Salvador, but as you can see, it is bordered by Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Well, it's near Nicaragua. And in particular, I conducted this work in this region called Morazan. So doing work in this particular region is important because this is the poorest region in El Salvador. It's the most marginalized, and it suffers from the highest rates of chronic child malnutrition. I just wanted to include this map here. It's a hunger map. It shows you the levels of malnutrition in the children under five in this area. And as you can see there, this region of Morazan has the most, has the highest level of malnutrition there. So the objectives of this study were to, one, identify the most salient determinants of food security in this region, as well as to identify the pre-existing food security related interventions or programs that already exist. And I'll get into a little bit later about why that's important. So I am still in the process of working on this work, but today I'm presenting work on the primary data that I gathered through semi-structured interviews. I conducted these interviews. I intended to get 20. I ended up getting 10 because I was sick during the summer. And that's just the glory of doing field work. But I was very thankful to have gotten those 10 interviews done with different caregivers, agricultural and health professionals. So the interviews were conducted and then transcribed in Spanish. And then I reviewed them after they were transcribed just for the sake of time. I had those transcribed by a professional company because transcription takes a very long time if you're not familiar with that. And then I thematically coded and analyzed the interview transcript. So now we'll dive into a little bit of some information, some of the results. This chart just displays who participated in this study. Like I said, I conducted 10 interviews. I used pseudonyms here in order to be anonymous and protect the informant. And as you can see, all but one were male, and the male was also the agricultural professional. two others were healthcare professionals. There was a nurse and there was a community health promoter. Four were single mothers, while these six others were either married or what's locally termed as accompanied, so it's kind of like a civil union. And half of the families described their income as very little or not enough, while the others described their income as along the lines of basic or good. So here I wanted to place this picture with, of course, the contrast. So here someone is saying that we don't have food security here in Waterfront. We don't manage that concept. We don't have that here. It doesn't exist. That was a recurring theme throughout these interviews that I conducted with these individuals. And I thought, I was taking different pictures throughout the area, and this photo comes from a local town store that many families frequent in order to get their everyday needs. So that includes shampoo, deodorant, so things like that, as well as their fruits and vegetables. And so this was actually one of the best options that I found in the area where the fruits and vegetables seemed fresh and the quality was really nice. So now I'd like to go into some of the emerging themes. One important theme that has emerged is this concept of diet delocalization. And so I've included here a quote from one of the interviews. So Patricia says, "We cultivate, but we sell it. But we don't eat it. Why? So that we can buy a box of chicken nuggets, a box of chicken wings, some sausages, right?" And so what this quote is getting into is this cycle of producing in order to sell, in order to buy something that's less beneficial for your health. So others have talked about this theme of diet delocalization. But what has been talked about is really people going from a rural community to work in an urban setting, and then they consume those foods in that urban setting. But what this is really displaying is that there's this cycle here where even though people are producing food in their communities, they're not eating it. You know, so all of that nutritional benefit that would come from those foods, they're missing out of it. And they're replacing it with these foods, these processed foods that have more of the westernized prestigious label tied to them. And I think recognizing that cycle is really important. Another theme that emerged relied on this cycle of dependence on handouts. So here Santa says, "There are many efforts. They come and start home gardens, but they go and give them the seeds, the supplies, everything, but they don't wake up people's consciousness. So we end up creating patterns of welfareism." And so this is a little bit self-explanatory, where you see the cycle of just dependence on people giving, different organizations giving things, but not really creating sustainable change within the community. And I'll go in a little bit into why that's important as well within this particular region in El Salvador. One other important theme was this desire for education, awareness, and training. So here Sarah says, "It's important for mothers to receive training because we are the ones at home to try to educate our children. Sometimes if the mother isn't educated about how to appropriately feed her children, she can't correct by example because she herself hasn't learned." So this particular theme was very exciting for me because it shows an opportunity for training and not just giving and relying on handouts. So I thought that this was a theme that really continued to come up within the interviews. So what does this all mean? Why does this even matter? You know, why are we all sitting here and listening to this right now? Right. So first, I wanted to tie in the last two themes, this cycle of welfareism and the opportunity or the desire for training. I think that in order to really establish some sustainable change, we have to train and not just give out things, but actually provide resources in order to create some type of sustainable change. So as you mentioned, you know, really getting to families where they are, thank you, getting to families where they are, how they're living, and going from there. Trying to do top-down structured options that were created in a lab or created outside of that context, we see that it doesn't work. Another thing that I wanted to point out is this pattern of diet delocalization. It kind of parallels when we think about Latinos who live in the U.S. under similar circumstances. And so you can think about the presence of convenience stores, or as you may call it, the bodegas. And usually within these convenience stores, you know, as he mentioned, you do have limited choices with a higher price, price tag tied to that. And that seems to be evident throughout the developing world as well. Actually developing in quotation marks there. So there's this increased access to these processed food products while at the same time there are fruits and vegetables, but the quality is questionable there. And a lot of the caregivers mentioned that. So within this rural region, you have to travel about an hour and a half in order to get to a bigger grocery store. So they really are relying on these local stores that are very small. They're usually owned by a family, and it's in that family's home. And you can understand why there are more processed foods available, because those hold up, you know, and the family isn't actually making a loss by providing those products. There's also, I wanted to mention the parallel with the cycle of welfareism within the U.S. as well. So, you know, we do have all these different government aid programs, such as WIC and food stamps. And there's this parallel of the cycle of dependence as well here in the U.S. and in other contexts. And so I think it's important for us to open our geographical maps and take an interest in realizing the different similarities that we are all experiencing throughout the world in relation to food security and health. So like I said, these results are fresh, hot off the press. So I am still in the process of really getting into this work and trying to figure out what is all here. So a few of the next steps that I'd like to do myself is to pair the information from the interviews with a document analysis. I was able to get some good information from caregivers and related to the different resources that are available, and I actually had the opportunity to visit some of those resources. So there were some caregivers were really happy with those resources and some weren't. And that ties back to the cycle of welfareism there. And so I'd like to go back and do a document analysis and then use both data sources in order to form situational maps, in order to really get a more comprehensive picture of what's going on in this region. And then, you know, I don't want this work just for myself. I'm not doing this for myself just because it's interesting. I would like to potentially collaborate with local organizations. I actually met up with one organization, and they were really excited about these interviews, but they really seemed like they just wanted to just get my information and go. So I have to see how to balance that out. And then I would like to start a community report based on this findings, and then also going on that theme of how there's this desire for training, work with different local organizations in order to give people what they want, provide these trainings with the different caregivers that are there. So I actually zoomed through this pretty quickly, quicker than I thought I would. But before I end, I would like to thank the following people: Sylvia Garcia for her support since the conception of the interview guide, Dr. Lloyd Francis, who is my advisor, Alan Burns and Alva and Maya Burns for their guidance. They're actually the two professors that introduced me to this region in El Salvador. Mr. Brenneman for his insightful comments on this particular topic. And I would also like to thank all of the participants who really shared their experiences with me. And I would also like to acknowledge the funding from the National Science Foundation, as I'm a National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellow. And so I'd also like to thank you all for your time and attention. And this is just a picture of the beautiful landscape of the region in El Salvador, Morazan. Thank you.